So, Arusha Volunteer Day is the other thing that's coming up 2 weeks from now on Saturday, June 13th. It's the other thing you'll see in your bulletin there. Arusha is Portuguese for the rock, which I'm assuming is Jesus Christ, and it's a ministry of Christians and conservation. So, if you guys have never been to the Arusha property, it's basically a farming property. That's what it's designated as. And Volunteer Day is going to consist of conservation projects. It's going to consist of us getting our hands into farming, into conservation projects and eating. Farming, conservation, and eating. 3 hours of work with your hands, followed by a free meal for volunteers. So some of the farming proceeds that we do, that goes on in Arusha goes to families in need. But Arusha looks at what they do, not just from how can we grow food for people in need, but from a broader Christian conservationist perspective. And the reason we're getting involved with this, from my perspective, is because we want to tie up a few loose ends as a church. And by loose ends, I mean the goals that we set when we first sat down and envisioned what Redemption Community Church would be. And we wrote down some things that we would like to see in our church. And one of those things that came up was a high degree of community involvement. That's one of our goals. That's one of the cultural goals that we want to have here is community involvement. We want to engage with contemporary issues. And when we do that, we just don't want to just keep busy. We want to bring an explicit Christian perspective to that. And one of the things about Christians that is pretty much true across the board is that we want our faith to spill out beyond the church walls. We want it to spill over every area of our lives and the lives of the people that we touch. So if you ask a Christian anywhere in Canada or the United States whether their faith should transform the social landscape, you get a resounding yes. This is one of the things that characterizes Christian culture, is that we want our faith not to just be this little private thing that we do, but we want it to have implications in the broader society. We want that. We really give a resounding yes to that whenever asked. And one of the major contemporary issues on our social landscape, especially here in BC, is the environment. So if you ask the question, should our faith transform that as well? The answer has to be a yes. If we want our faith to have that spillover into everything, then it must also include environmental issues. After all, we worship a God who we identify as the creator of heaven and earth. He is the Lord of everything. So there's in a sense that, of course, our faith will affect how we interact with the creation that God has made. But there's also a problem to this. As much as you can ask any Christian anywhere across the board whether their faith should spill over into broader issues, when it comes to asking those same Christians, what exactly does that mean? When you talk about the faith spilling over, when you have, of your faith having implications, what are those implications? And we're characterized by a fuzziness, a lack of detail, a lack of an ability to express in practical terms what we mean by this passion that we have. So it doesn't, and this doesn't matter whether you ask people in the pews or whether you ask the educated leaders and the pastors. That's something that you can expect from Christians. Passion for social involvement, fuzziness as to what that looks like. We like the general idea, but we can't seem to push very far past that. And here at Redemption, I think we're no different. One of the explicit statements we put in our goal, core values was about caring for God's creation. But when it comes to practically expressing that, we haven't been able to move beyond buying biodegradable cups for coffee. That's kind of where it stopped in the space of about 2 years now, which, again, that's characteristic. But I don't want to be too hard on ourselves because there's things. This is also true of most Canadians, and this is something I came across. I'm going to give you a statement here that is common on surveys of Canadians, like Stats Canada uses this question on their census. And this is a statement that 94% of Canadians agree with. That is a shocking amount of agreement. There's only 6% of some 30 million people that would disagree with this. So here's a statement. It is important to be very involved in the community you live in. It's important to be very involved. Not just involved, think, okay, I like the idea of involvement. It is important to be very involved in the community you live in. 94% of Canadians agree with that. But then when you ask those same Canadians, okay, well, how many hours do you volunteer? What causes and charities do you give with? Less than half of Canadians actually volunteer and contribute to their time or the money to their local community. So there's kind of like this national hypocrisy that goes on where Canadians like the idea of involvement but don't really manifest it in a way that's consistent with their words. So we're in the same boat. And when you look at, then you can look at that group further. When you ask those that do volunteer, so there's like something like 46% of Canadians do engage in some sort of volunteering, and you ask them, why? Why do you volunteer? And about 60 to 70% of the people that do actually volunteer say they do so for explicitly religious reasons. That's what they say motivates them. So there's a three-tiered argument going on here. You see, 94, like vast majority of Canadians agree we should be community involvement. Half of us, less than half of us, actually follow up on it. And about 60 to 70% of the people that do volunteer do so because their faith in some way motivates them to do so. So when it comes to Arusha Volunteer Day and coming to why we're doing this, if I'm going to be looking at the answer that's going to resonate with the people who are most likely to volunteer, I think the answer is this. The reason you would help out at Arusha Volunteer Day and getting your hands dirty with farming and sitting around together eating is because you worship the God who made heaven and earth. And you believe with all your heart that what God made is good and worth investing in. Arusha is about Christians getting involved in conservation issues. And I want to just recognize that this is a bit of a problem because I have not been able to find a term that is not politically loaded. Conservation is a loaded term. And I just want to acknowledge that there's a lot of weird stuff that goes on in green circles. I remember when I was first became of the age eligible to vote. It's the first election I ever became involved in, and I wanted to be studious and conscientious, and so I looked at the different political party platforms, including the Green Party. And this was sometime in the late 90s. And one of the key platforms, planks in the platform of the Green Party at that time, was to raise the gas prices 40 cents a liter. And the whole idea behind that is if we jack up the gas prices, that will force people to commute more, and then we'll save on pollution. And kind of the joke in retrospect is that gas prices at that time sat around between 50 to 60 cents a liter. So it's one of these things we can look back and it's like, wow, let's bring back the Green Party's gas platform. That would be a nice thing. And ever since that time of just really looking into environmental issues, I've kept a wary eye on the environmental movement. Some of the stuff I like, some of the stuff I don't like. And I just have to say, it is not uncommon for the movement of conservation as a whole to advocate for sometimes out of touch, idealistic, and expensive things that won't make a measurable difference to the environment. And that's not a good thing. And so one of the key reasons Christians do need to get involved in conservation is the very weirdness that sometimes goes on in green circles. When sociologists compare Christian subcultures to the rest of Canada, Christians are characterized by an enormous generosity, both in time and money. Even when it comes to how we engage in politically charged issues, we are characterized by civility. We don't like political nattering. We are the most likely group of Canadians to disapprove of behavior that disrupts society. We don't like it. We don't think that's how God wants us to engage. And I think in regards to the political side of environmentalism, Christians need to bring their culture of generosity and civility to the table. It's a movement in bad need of good Christians. So if you're like me, and I guess I won't be spending any more time on the political issue. I just wanted to acknowledge it. But if you're like me, when someone brings up something that sounds environmental, it gives you a bit of the heebie-jeebies. Two things always go through my head. I always ask, to what extent are you wasting my time and money? And two, to what extent are you trying to get me to join the granola crowd? So what I want to address in this message here, my primary concern is that this topic, the environment and conservation, is approached from an explicit biblical Christian perspective. And secondly, that it's actually practical and informed. And for that, I want to just spend the bulk of this message just looking at the first chapter of the Old Testament, Genesis 1. So one of the struggles we always face with the Old Testament is that the Old Testament is, by definition, old. It was written a long, long time ago. It was written before the Silicon Chip, before the Industrial Revolution, before the printing press, before even Jesus Christ. This was a time when the Word of God was not a tidy, well-bound book with pretty leather and nice binding. It was written down on dried animal skins. Moses didn't have the option of a nice little, 8x5x11 piece of paper that he gradually stacked up as he wrote it. His options of format were side of goat. And when you had to build these things up, you take a knife and you chop it and you sew them together. And a library smelled something like an abattoir. It was composed of animal skins. I find this imagery of the Word of God on this crinkly, dried up animal skin really helps me recognize and remember just how old the Old Testament is, and that there is a gap, that whenever we read it, we leap across centuries, language, land, and culture. Whenever we pick up the Bible, we are in a constant danger zone of smothering the author with 21st century first world problems. So before we read Genesis 1, I want to take a look at Moses, just the author. How did he live? What did he do? What was he all about? And this is significant because Moses wasn't just some guy that started writing and wrote some things that happened to be preserved. Moses was chosen by God to write the first chapters of the written word. Now, Moses was a guy who spent the bulk of his time, just career-wise, sorting out legal disputes between people. He dealt with issues of property, inheritance, cases of murder, military policy, and religious laws. Now when someone says Moses, I don't think of that. I think of some guy that looks roughly like Charlton Heston. He's got a big beard, and he brought the plagues on Egypt, or the instrument of God to bring the plagues on Egypt. He split the Red Sea with a voice like Val Kilmer, and he met God face to face and received the Ten Commandments on tablets of stone in fairly colorful, nice-looking robes, just like it is in my daughter's Precious Moments Bible. That's what I think of when I think of Moses, these watershed events of his life. But the bulk of Moses' professional life was spent sitting down, listening to people, and settling their disputes. And not just easy cases, he did that dawn to dusk, the difficult cases of people. That's Moses, that's who wrote this. And I think part of helping people settle disputes is helping them see the world differently. One of the themes that comes up over and over again in the Old Testament is trying to get the people of Israel not to look at things from the point of view of the religions around them. And again, before we read excerpts of Genesis 1 here, I want to look at the point of view that these people had, that Moses was regularly interacting with and trying to get them to see things differently. One of the best preserved ancient Near Eastern stories. So we're going to talk about how they saw the creation. We're going to read the biblical creation, but I think it's important to know how the people of the time thought of heaven and earth. One of the best preserved ancient Near Eastern stories comes from Babylonian mythology. And it talks about the arch goddess Tiamat. That's how the story starts. There is Tiamat, was her name. She was this kind of giant person thing of mixed up, made up of chaos and basic elements, but was also a person in some way. Tiamat had children with another god, and eventually these children rose up in rebellion against her, led by the storm god Marduk. Marduk was kind of the Babylonian equivalent of Thor. He was the storm god, is the major figure in Babylonian mythology. So Marduk and his siblings waged war against Tiamat, and after defeating her with an array of magical weaponry, Marduk stood on top of her, smashed her skull in with a club, and then tore her body into pieces. And with those pieces, the storm god Marduk formed heaven and earth from Tiamat's body. So Tiamat's ribcage formed the sky, and the tears from her eyes formed the Euphrates River. Another half of her was the land, and so forth. So we have this god creating heavens and earth from the limbs and pieces of this arch goddess of chaos and basic elements. So Marduk thus formed the heavens and the earth. But there was a problem here in that this heavens and the earth made from Tiamat's body had work in it for the gods to do. And there's nothing the gods hated more than work. Work was beneath the gods. Gods like to relax. They take it easy. They bask in their own glory. And above all, they want rest. They want to nap. So the gods took some god blood and mixed it with red clay and made a whole pile of humans to do the work that the gods didn't want to do. So the gods could take it easy. All things were well. The gods can nap now. The humans are doing all the drudge work. But there came to be a problem with the humans. The humans, as they grew and become more numerous, they became increasingly noisier. And this human noise was a problem for the Babylonian gods, as they could not nap while the humans made all this noise. So periodically, the gods would come down and wipe out most of the humans to teach them a lesson about being quiet. So the gods could get some rest, and the humans would learn their place. Their place is to serve the gods. So that's the basic structure of the Babylonian myth, and that was one example of several that were very similar. There's other versions have the gods kind of like digging in the earth, oh, well, we hate this, and then, oh, pop humans from a hole that they dug. Oh, let's make them do the work. So there's different versions of this, but they all have a couple of things in common. In every case, humans are made in a massive group, and their sole purpose was to do the work that the gods didn't want to do. Now, some scholars have looked at these ancient Near Eastern stories and said that they were created to justify some of the political structures at the time, the ancient Near Eastern city-states, where the economies were built around the masses, providing labor for certain gods and kings and other privileged priestly castes. So that's kind of the point of view of these people that Moses is spending his time trying to sort out and help them see things differently. Personally, I like these myths from strictly a parenting point of view. Like, can you imagine living in a society where the whole thing, your whole mythos revolves around staying quiet so that the gods don't get you? Like, if the kids are being too noisy, he's like, hey, I think I hear Marduk. Then you as a parent can go have a nap, right? It's perfect. It's set up for easy parenting. But going back to Genesis, let's read the story of the Bible by contrast. And I'm not going to read the whole chapter. I'm just going through excerpts that I think highlight just how different this way of seeing the world is. So Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures. And let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm, according to their kinds. And every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And going a bit further to the pinnacle of creation week, he says, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And then God rests. God blesses the Sabbath and declares a day of rest, not just for God, but for everyone. For the creation itself, in fact. So three things stand out as especially distinct about the Genesis creation story when you compare it to ancient Near Eastern mythology. The first things that Moses deals with is that God is distinct from the creation. The formless void that the Spirit of God hovers over in Genesis was not the body of Tiamat. Remember, Tiamat was characterized by being this kind of basic element, kind of void creature, void deity. The formless void was not the body of Tiamat. Notice also the lack of war. The creation of the world did not come about as some epic conflict between roughly equal divine forces. In Genesis 1, God speaks the creation into being because he wants to. He says, he just speaks and it is. God doesn't depend on the creation. God didn't come from it as Marduk came from Tiamat. God didn't create because he had some work that he didn't like to do. In Genesis 1, God himself chooses to work. The creation didn't relieve God of unpleasant duties. It is the product of his good pleasure. He makes it, he sees it, and says, it is good. It's been said that Christianity is a two-circled worldview. If you were to reduce it to kind of like, look at different religions and ways of viewing the world into basic, the kind of simplest illustration you can think of. Do some circles. Christianity is a two-circled worldview. There is God, and there is his creation. God is not to be mistaken for his creation. God wasn't lacking something and so needed to create. It is not like an overlapping circle. It's not like the creation is a piece of God and shares parts of him or attributes of him. God is entirely distinct from his creation. And it's not like there's a single-circled worldview where there is nothing but, as in atheism, where there is nothing but just matter and forces, and neither would it be like another version of the single circle would be just saying the whole universe is divine in itself. Two circles is what characterizes and is absolutely unique about the Christian worldview. The second thing that stands out about the Genesis account is how people are viewed. Mankind is not a mere object of service and slavery for the gods. People are said to be made in God's image. They are made for a unique relationship to God, the relationship of a kind of political ambassador. What is meant by the image of God has been the subject of an ongoing debate throughout the ages. And a lot of the early church writers said that what Moses meant by the image of God is the reason and mind of man. That was what it was. It wasn't his body, because all of the early church writers were educated in Greek and Roman schools. And in Greek thinking, there is matter and there is mind. Matter is bad, mind is good. And so pretty well all of the early church made some form of compromise to this idea and said that the image of God is reason, it's not body. And so a lot of early church history is characterized by abuse of the body and or neglect of it, not seeing the relationship of the creation to God declaring it good. So unfortunately, the early church made a lot of compromises to Greek ideas here. But by contrast, I think what you have here, the image of God, encompasses the whole person. We're not merely embodied minds, but God created us as an entire unity. We have bodies. God doesn't say only the mind is the image of God. He says humans are, in their totality, mind, emotions, will, and body. It is that totality that is the image of God. And the explanation of the image of God that I find most persuasive as to what is meant by this phrase that has spawned so much discussion, the one I find most persuasive is one that takes us back to the ancient Near Eastern context and how the word image was used back then. So if you lived in ancient Near East, just a part of your daily life and a part of the city or town you lived in was priests and temples, just everywhere. We're kind of in a sort of a temple here. So imagine any temple you walk into would have an image. It was, and this image was the image of whatever the guy was that ruled the area. There was always the image of the ruling king of the area in any temple. And the whole purpose of this image of the king was to serve as the presence of the ruler when he was absent. And so these images were treated as the kings. You respected the image. You feared the image. It represented him. And I think Moses is using this language of the image to describe the presence and authority and dominion of the ruler, in this case, God. So if that's what Moses is referring to, what he's doing, he's taking a concept that his readers would have been familiar with, and he's saying that human beings are the image of the ultimate king, God. Humans serve as his presence and exercise his dominion in the name of the Creator. Humans are God's political and ruling ambassadors, so to speak, of the creation. So the meaning of the command then, when God says, fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it, roughly means this: fill the earth with God's presence. Bring the creation into a state of completeness and order as a representative of its creator. And the third major difference in Genesis is that the creation is not haunted by many deities of various stripes and power. So in Babylonian mythology, I mean, he takes, Marduk needs a moon, and so he finds some god and says, well, you're going to be the moon. And he assigns various deities to various tasks throughout the creation, and some are happy about their role, some are unhappy about it. By contrast, the Genesis account has the moon and the stars all being good created things, which is very different from a bunch of deities like the sea and the moon who may be at war with each other. And that's what you have in Babylonian mythology. When you're looking at the creation itself, the creation is at war with itself. It always has been. It was made from the body of Tiamat, which was at war with her children. The creation is characterized by conflict. But in God's scheme, all of the parts of the creation fit together in a unity. The creation is one united, harmonious whole. In the ancient Near Eastern myths, might makes right. How does the creation sort itself out? Well, the raw power of Marduk. The storm god kind of beats all the other gods into place, tells them what to do, and quells all the uprisings and conflicts simply by sheer power. Order comes through one deity conquering another and keeping conflicted interests in harmony by sheer force of power. In Genesis, the creation is not divine, but is the harmonious creation of a good God. There's a unity to it that is not present in the ancient Near Eastern stories. So what does this all have to do with nowadays? And I think it says a whole lot to us on a daily basis. As an aside, I have met too many people. This has been one of the heart-wrenching things that continues to bother me. So maybe this is a bit of a, if I can share a bit of a pet peeve here. Christians and non-Christians who pick up the book of Moses and either have their faith shaken by passages that make no sense as standalone texts, that texts that don't speak to them, or who read it and see it all as the nattering of dated religious weirdos of some kind. The word of God is in one sense bound up and tied and mute by again, 21st century concerns. So again, kind of as an aside to the issues of conservation and creation, I think it's important to know some of these background stories so that we can recognize what the main point of a passage is, rather than missing important truths by just smothering an author in 21st century baggage. So to reiterate, the Genesis account gives at least three major rebuttals to every other story the people of the ancient Near Eastern knew. God is distinct from creation. He's not subject to it, and he's not the product of it. Man is a ruling ambassador of God over the whole creation. And third, the creation is not divine. It's made to glorify the divine and point to the one true God, but it itself has zero divine qualities. So I think that these three main points of Moses do have relevance to us in the 21st century, because it's not like we're stuck in the past and we just read history for the fun of it. The goal of the text is to walk with God, and we need to walk with God everywhere, across all times and places. God gave us, in the 21st century, Genesis 1, as a guide to life, which challenges the way we think about the world, about us, about work especially, and about ourselves, as much as he gave it to the believers in the ancient Near East. So I want to wrap up by giving one contemporary application. And this, I have to confess, this has been just torture to put together, because this passage is so rich with so much stuff, and I had to pick one. So I'm picking it. And it pains me to do this, but I think it would pain you guys if I continued to go on and on. So I picked one. And it is the point of conservation. And I think this follows pretty naturally from being called God's image, his ambassadors. I don't think it's the only thing in the text of Genesis 1, but think about this. We are charged as a whole and as individuals. We are charged by God with the task of bringing God's presence to the entire world. We are charged with the task of bringing God's presence to the whole world. That's part of the definition of having dominion. That's the first thing God wanted in his word, was people to know this. That's part of the definition of what it means to be a human being. And that, above all any other considerations, is why Christians engage in conservation. Conservation is a part of what has to take place as humans fill the earth. Humans are to be the dominant presence. That's not a problem. There's no warning against overpopulation or notion of humans as some invasive, overly dominant species here. It's quite the opposite. If the background of Genesis 1 is this notion of the humans becoming too numerous and noisy and annoying the gods, when Moses says, fill the earth and have dominion over it, this is a direct attack on ancient Near Eastern concepts of overpopulation. So to wrap up by going back to the original problem I started with that we experience as Christians, translating the desire for our faith to spill over into our society, I think it's important to recognize that that desire is God-given. It's wedded to the image of God in you. And our attempts to express that by organizing a volunteer day at Arasha is an opportunity to express that faith. It's one way, among many, to be God's ambassador. And I think it's a direct expression that it gets our hands dirty in the dirt, in the creation, that is an expression of the command to oversee that blessing that God gave the earth, to see the earth filled with life. That's what he wants. That's the task he's charged us to do.